Welcome, everyone, to another episode of the Veterans in Ag podcast, brought to you by AGD Consulting. I'm your host, Mike DeSop, and here we explore the stories and insights from the military veteran and supporter communities who are leading the way for vets in agribusiness, ag tech, and agripreneurship. We swap stories, talk ag, and show how the grassroots nature of the ag community can be a natural fit for the military veteran. During the interview, our guest on the podcast this week said, quote, "Farmers and ranchers are the ones that are going to have to do the change, but the ones that are going to push for change are outside agriculture." Our guest this week is Eric Fuchs. Eric is a U.S. Air Force veteran and consultant with Understanding Ag. In this capacity, he works specifically with all aspects of the drinking water industry with an emphasis on source water production in the agricultural community. Eric and his wife also own a livestock operation in Missouri, where they use regenerative techniques with holistic grazing and soil health practices. Eric's earlier quote gives us some insight into how he thinks about change and where it can originate from. Eric is one of the few who was able to purchase his own farm while still in the Air Force and make it work as a business over the next 20 years. Eric is a great storyteller, and in this episode, we take listeners through how he did this, how practices and the conversations have changed drastically, even in the last 5 years, around regenerative ag, and what the future could look like between Understanding Ag and the military veteran community.
My dad was a part-time farmer and a mail carrier, so grew up with it, you know, the typical hog, cow, little bit of diversified operation, always worked, he always worked part-time. And then went to college, got a degree in agriculture, and I actually went into ROTC to go into the Air Force. I think I was the only ag major in officer training in ROTC. You know, everybody else was computer science and all the engineering type stuff, and I was an ag major. So did a little stint in the Air Force, did about 5 years, really enjoyed it. But I always had a passion for, different agriculture. I always say I became weird in about 1993. When at my senior year in college, I took a class with Jim Garish, and many of you know that name. And Jim kind of showed me at the time managed intensive grazing, and that was, I just never looked back. Got trained in holistic management after that. Always had a grazing system, got trained in soil health, and just really went down this road of my mantra was, if everybody was looking one way, I would look the other way. And it seems like that has really served me well. And about 4 years ago, I had always known Gay Brown and Dr. Alan Williams and some of the work they were doing. And about 4 years ago, they asked me to do a webinar because I had got involved in drinking water and was kind of tying in water and agriculture. And they had me do a webinar, and shortly after that, they asked me to come on and be a consultant. And I have to say, I don't think there's anybody that's got a better job in the world than I do right now. I get to travel the country, work with all kinds of different producers, and get to do things like this. So it's been a good career.
Eric, were your parents contrarians in the farming space in the early 90s?
They really weren't, which was interesting. But my dad, I was the youngest of three. And when I came along, it wasn't quite as adamant that we had to make money off the farm. My dad always considered the farm was going to be a losing opportunity. But then once I started showing him different things that we could do, like the grazing systems, he was all in. So he, you know, and that's what we see kind of in our consulting world. It really is not age dependent. You know, you have young kids that don't see it, and then you have older ones that do. And that's how my dad was. He became more excited in the last years of his ag career or ag work than he had ever had been before. And it was really cool to see that.
How did you get introduced to Gay Brown and Alan Williams?
You know, this world of, you know, what it really wasn't called regenerative agriculture, but I have to say the world of actually doing things different than the norm, it was a pretty small world. And Alan, I've probably known Alan for 25 years back in the grass-fed business. There was a group called Tall Grass that was ran by Bill Curtis, an investigative reporter, TV star. And I learned, you know, Alan, I had heard of him and got to meet him there with the grass-fed exchanges. And Gabe, anything that has to do with any kind of soil health, you started seeing. So different places, different trainings I'd gone to, different times I'd heard him speak. Again, Doug Peterson, I can throw out a lot of different names that we all kind of, it was just a small knit group, Jim Gerrish, a lot of the pioneers of this thing. And that's how I met both Gabe and Alan.
When you were going through the Air Force, did you have a sense of whether or not you were for sure wanting to go back to agriculture?
It at the time, and in fact, I bought my farm when I was in the military, and my dad had a family farm, but then I bought my own, and I always didn't think I was going to do the military as a career. Looking back now, when I see a lot of my counterparts that are retiring as colonels, and even had an old college roommate that's a one star, I'm thinking maybe I should have stayed in, but I got out at a good time, but I always knew I wanted to come back to the farm and do something. And to be honest, the 5 years in the military was one of the best things I could have ever done, that prepares you for working with different people, for being able to travel, just getting away from home and actually seeing that there's a different group of people around the world. So, but I always knew I wanted to come back and do something in agriculture.
Was there any way you were able to sort of keep ties, if you will, into the industry while you were doing that?
Believe it or not, there was. I was in the
Also.
military some of the most boring times that there were. And so I never got out of the States. I was stationed about 3 hours away from home at Little Rock Air Force Base. And then I was about 8 hours from home when I was down in Georgia. So I always kept, in fact, I always had took the Stockman Grass Farmer. So I was always into it. I was always working with my dad on things that they were doing on the farm. So I never really disconnected with it completely. And that was a good thing, because there was a lot of changes from when I graduated college, from when I went and got out of the Air Force. Jim Gerrish had really made huge strides in Missouri on grazing systems and things like that. So that 5 year stretch, there was a lot of changes.
You always, it would be really only being in ag tech specific for about 10 years. When you talk about starting to look at regenerative ag as early as the 90s, that seems much further back than what's sort of predominantly discussed or what's in, headlines today about, these types of farming practices being new and novel, but it doesn't sound like at this point, close to 30 years ago, you were already thinking about and implementing these systems. What about them for you so early on in this process was confirmatory of it being a place that you wanted to be and practice long term?
It was funny. Maybe it was the observation skills, but it just worked. It just made sense. And I remember going through college, and I got a soils degree, or it was called agronomy at the time, and it just didn't thrill me. It's just everything was fertilizers, and I wasn't that much of a contrarian, but it just didn't thrill me. But when I went out, I'll never forget, and when I went out and saw a grazing system set up at a research farm on the University of Missouri that Jim Gerrish was running, I'm like, wow, this makes sense. And they talked about not having to feed hay, and I don't know, maybe part of it was just trying to do something, like you said, the contrarian attitude, doing something that everybody said couldn't work, but everything of it just made sense, and it was nature. And also, I was always trying to, skimp and save money. And it seemed to be ways that I could do things, still get good results, and not have all these overhead or all these expenses. Because you have to understand, at this time, at about that point, about 28 years old, I had bought my first farm. And my gosh, it was like, it was so hard to try to pay for. So I was always looking for things to cut back. And I remember the first thing was selling all the hay equipment. And I'm like, wow, I have a lot more money left over. So I think it was a combination of seeing results and also seeing the much less inputs and cost of operation.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that because in some, previous interviews you had done, you talked about early practitioner of these conventional grazing and agricultural methods and the difficulty of being profitable using those methods. And I was going to ask you what the crux of that was, but it sounds like it was a combination of the equipment required and the inputs that went in. But when you started to get a sense of what these regenerative practices could do to not only improve the overall ecosystem, but also help make you more profitable in the end. I mean, that's, am I thinking about or sort of reiterating those sort of early thoughts correctly as to one of the draws for you to these types of practice?
It was a huge draw because, you know, at 28, 30 years old, honestly, taking care of the ecosystem and the environment was not something that just thrilled me at the time. Yeah. You know,
right.
As I get older, it's tremendously, but what I see now compared, you know, back then it was a lot about savings, but what I find in the regenerative, we'll use that term from here, you know, right. if I'm into ecology and environment, well, regenerative solves that problem. If I'm into wildlife, I want much, and I got in down the net kick for a while, you know, wanted better deer populations, different things. Well, guess what? Regenerative solves that. If I just want to make more money on my operation, well, regenerative solves that. And it's really what I've seen in the last 10 to 15 years is like all the things that a lot of different people, you know, food health, nutrient dense food. There's so many things that I say, no matter what your passion may be on an operation, the regenerative path seems to be something that can get you there. And like for me, it started out on expenses, on saving money. And it's like that when we consult, you know, we've got that principle called context. So many people come at it so many different directions, and it's so easy just to roll right in on them and say, okay, well, we can help solve that problem. And so that's what's really neat about this. I started for one reason, but there's so many different reasons that people come this path.
When you guys first start to engage with new clients about these different practices, I would suspect that you pretty immediately see pushback if you start to make recommendations around practice changes that in some cases are generations old. Yeah. Would you agree with that initial pushback? And if so, how do you begin to change these generational mindsets?
Boy, that's a loaded question and a very, very, very good question, because, you know, I have to start, you know, kind of start when I first came into the consulting world. You just come, you know, you're gung-ho and you want to come at it 100 mile an hour, and everything you know is right and everything they're doing is wrong. And that's where I come back to that principle of context. You know, you have to meet them where they're at, and you have to know what they can accept and what they can't. And every single client is different. And so I think number one is consultants, you know, it's great that we're all producers. It's great that we all have that on that hands-on knowledge, but our number one tool is to being able to communicate, to be able to come into somebody that has done it this way their whole life. Now, granted, they've already asked us to come there, so they're already reaching for some change, they're already reaching for something different. But it is so different with every single one because of, like you said, what they can accept. Something that they have been told their entire life they're doing is this way is right, this is the way to do it. And we're just kind of saying, well, maybe have you looked at it this way? And so it's really interesting because every one of them are different. And you try to push them or give them enough to able to accept it, but not so much that you just shut them up. Because if you overwhelm them with it, they're just like, well, we'll just go back to the same way. So a lot of after our visit or after first consult is where the work really starts, you know, because they have questions and they need somebody to hold their hand. And I joke, is somebody give them a virtual hug every now and then, said, it will be all right, just try this, you know. But it's such a gradient approach is what we try to do too. You know, don't come home and sell everything and do like I do. I always was that guy that went to a conference somewhere and came home and changed my entire operation overnight, you know. Don't do the things I did, you know, change a little at a time. But it is so much fun working with, you know, I've got a client down in Tennessee that's in his 80s and conventional farmer all of his life. And to see the things he does and the path he changes and is excited to continue to do it because of what we help him with and what we teach.
What is typically that most entrenched practice or habit?
Wow. You know, it probably depends on what it is, but try, you know, whether you're in a ranching, farming, ranching type thing or row crop, but even in everything is, I think the biggest thing is that entrenched fertility type thing. You know, you must fertilize or you must use this amount or that we can't do this without that. Probably second is feeding hay. You know, the entrenched, whether, you know, Jim Garrish has got a great quote, whether you're in Florida or Canada, the amount of hay we feed, the amount of months we feed hay is the same. So it has nothing to do with cold, where you're at in the country. It is an ingrained thing. So stuff like that, you know, that we must use these inputs. And I could almost blanket as all as the inputs, trying to see an input that we just know and have been taught that has to be used, fertilizers, pesticides, you know, spraying pastures, things like that, and say, you know, maybe we don't have to do this. Maybe we can cut back on this. And so, you know, it's a hard question to answer because each individual person has something different. But no doubt it's, you know, in regenerative agriculture, in a nutshell, we're going to try to go from a chemical system to a biological system.
Right.
So when
right.
you explain it in that way, how many things that we use that are a chemical system that we just know has to come. I was in a conversation with some friends of ours because we've not fed any hay. We had 6 or 7 inches of snow. And granted, Southeast Missouri doesn't get real wild, but winters. But, you know, some folks are like, well, how do you, but you have to feed them. And I sent them pictures of them out there grazing stockpile. How do you do that? How do you, you know, and it's, they're a young couple. It's all they've ever known. And so it's just so hard sometimes because that's just how we've always done it.
Unpack that. The particular comment about not feeding in the winter months is interesting to me. We've got probably a small herd, and it's an Agricola or a Piney Woods cattle herd.
Yeah.
So it's an older heritage breed. There's sort of, they look a lot like Longhorns, and they graze up as much as they sort of graze down in the winter months. And right now they're on a small pasture, probably 9 to 10 fenced acres or so. And there's 8, 9 head or so, one bull, mostly cows and a couple of young calves. And that grass is short right now, and we're feeding hay. And so I suspect that we're doing something wrong when it comes to their management or their rotation, such that, I mean, what's the sort of early step that folks like me or others can take to begin to sort of be hay independent, if you will?
Well, it's funny. So this is our first consult right here. We're getting ready to get it on. You know,
not that I was intending to go this way. However, we're here.
The first thing that pops in my mind, you said you had 10 acres of pasture and you've got 10 cows. Uh-huh. So way overstocked. And, okay. And there is almost not a place. Well, no, I should say every place we've ever gone in the country is overstocked and under, you know, overgrazed. And it's usually a benefit of economics and stuff like that. So, so from the stockpile standpoint, like we've got 220 acres of pasture and I've got about 70 cows down here right now. Yeah. So we're, you know, a lot less stocked. We're able to grow that forage and, you know, we've got fescue and stuff. It's 10, 15 inches tall right now, if not taller. And we just ration that out every day and let them eat that. And it's funny, the cows will not want to do that sometimes, you know, so you've got to make them work for a living. You got cattle like you got, they will absolutely work for a living if you make them. But there's probably never a place, like I said, that I've gone to that's not a, we've got a consultant named Kent Donica has got a really good quote. He said, I've never been to an operation where I've stuck a shovel in the ground and say, boy, this soil looks a lot better than I've seen before.
Yeah.
He said, you'll never see an operation that says, you don't have enough cows, you ought to buy a few more. And they'll never see an operation that says your rest periods are too long, you ought to shorten them up. And that, in a nutshell, kind of explains your problem. You know, you get too many animals, the grass never can recover. So you just got a snowball effect, literally, of we're always out of grass. So we're always feeding hay. And I don't know what part of the country you're in, but that is that. And, but again, we always done it that way. We've always ran this many cows. We've always had this many. And it's just that mindset, and it's changing the way you see things and understand them, then to be able to get to the point of not having to do them anymore.
Yeah. It's kind of one of those things where you say, I think I know what the problem is, right? And you can, like, you see the problem every day when you go out there, but it's something different to then say, now I have to do something about correcting.
Yeah. That yeah. problem, and you know, right? That's the hardest thing is come up to the point to say, well, first of all, know that you don't know, you know, to be able to come up and say, oh, I did something different. And then that's the hard part, because now once you know or accept, wow, I have to change. It's sometimes easier not to know at all. Right. Because right. you don't have right. to change them. But so it's very interesting. Right. And in a nutshell, we just talked about a consults and how a lot of them are.
Right. What was that like for you when you first started working with Eric Chia with Army and his regenerative program? And you go out to Camp San Luis Obispo and you're looking at, you know, 2,500 acres or so and 140, 160 cow calf pairs. And they've got a couple of practitioners who have graciously accepted or offered to turn their herd over to this young major who wants to try this crazy multi-paddock, you know, adaptive grazing system. And somehow the stars align and they agree and he starts getting it right and he brings you in. But, you know, what was that sort of early experience like with you starting to work with Eric?
So now I have to admit, I've met Eric in an academy, but I've not actually went out and looked at where he's raising. Fair. But I know Eric very well, and I know Kent Donica has been out there. And I can tell you from my mindset, first of all, I think Eric is the luckiest guy in the world. I mean, how he's a major in the building. Yeah, I mean, he's out. And the coolest thing about somebody like Eric, and we find this time and time again, Eric didn't already have the bad habits. Eric didn't. He could learn. You know, I remember when I got qualified in a 9mm in the Air Force, it's the Air Force. We didn't shoot a lot, do a lot, but I already knew how to use a gun, right? I had shot at home and everything, so I didn't have to listen to him. I qualified terrible. The people that came in and listened completely and went through and trained exactly did so much better. And we find that in this world as well. Eric does not have to unlearn anything. I had all my college, everything else I had to unlearn. And so it's neat to see in what he's doing, the results he's getting, the fact that he's getting some conventional producers to allow him to do it with their cattle, which just shows how well a communicator he is, how he can explain things. And so he is setting a precedent, Mike, honestly, that can. We are so excited about his program because you know how much land the DOD owns?
Millions. I think he said 26 million acres, 13 of which belong to the Army.
That's it. It's
crazy.
That's it. And so think of the ecological benefits that can have. Think of it's just unbelievable what can be done with that. And he is the pioneer doing it. And the amount of people that are watching him, following him, taking notice of what he's doing is unbelievable. Yeah. Best job in the world.
Yeah, when he said my day job is getting out on the four-wheeler or the side-by-side and moving poly wire and just being out in that on a day-to-day mm-hmm. basis as an active duty major. I mean, dadgum, he drew a lucky
he drew the long straw
on that one. Yeah.
And his family's helping him the way I understand it. He's got everybody else involved. Yeah. So how neat. Yeah.
I mean, I fully agree with you that I told him, I said, you are on the cusp of something huge here, that if you can convince through these practices and the results of these practices, your leadership at your base, but beyond as well, the ability to affect real change as a result mm-hmm. of these practices is pretty significant.
And the people outside of agriculture, you know, that's the number one thing when we do a lot of trainings. And, you know, I'm on the board of the Soil Health Academy and we're doing some pilot academies. We're doing one for food, one for health, one for wildlife, and one for drinking water. And it's neat because we want to teach people, you know, the farmers and ranchers are the ones that are going to have to do the change, but the ones that are going to push the change are outside of agriculture. And it's really neat because you can train somebody or send somebody to a 2 or 3 day school and they're like, well, why isn't everybody doing this? It's a no-brainer to them, and it shows you the entrenched beliefs, you know, paradigms, things like that in agriculture that are so hard to change. And the ones outside, like Eric, can say, this works. And that's what's cool, too, because most of the folks he's going to be talking with are not going to be agriculture guys.
That's
They're going
right.
to be land, yeah, they're going to be land managers or policy makers or things like that. And that's one of the things we've seen in the realms of Soil Health Academy is who do we really need to be the, you know, to change and educate? We need policy makers. We need regulators. We need influencers, you know, folks like that, that are honestly going to be outside agriculture.
Yeah, I remember he was retelling the story when he was first presenting his thesis to his advisor at the Naval Pulse Graduate School. And he was sort of standing outside of our office and he wasn't sure whether or not he wanted to even bring up this idea of cows and grazing as a, you know, national food security issue. And he kind of walked into his advisor's office and she had, you know, pictures of cows all over. She was a rancher, I think, in out of Montana. And he goes, all right, conditions are set for me to open this conversation up. And the story sort of wrote itself from there. But your point about sometimes folks from the outside who don't have an entrenched perspective can not only be receptive to those new practices, but offer a clean set or a different set of lens through which to view the same problem.
Yes. And, you know, you've mentioned, you know, earlier that I've been in this world for like 30 years. Right. And, but the change in the last five, I mean, you know, we got presidential candidates talking about soil health, talking about nutrient dense food.
Yeah.
You know, Gabe is meeting with, you know, King Charles over on his lands and on the King of England. You know, you have CEOs of these companies and the people we're working with and fortunate enough to be working with, it's a better environment and opportunity than I've ever seen. I mean, you know, I don't know if it's a snowball effect. I don't know if people are just getting tired. I don't know what it is, but wow, it has really grown.
It's conditions and timing are quite ideal at this point. I'm curious to your perspective on this. I've heard Will Harris talk about this from White Oak Pastures before, and he's described these regenerative systems as being replicable, but not necessarily scalable in the traditional sense of the way things scale through volume and size. I mean, when you think about regenerative practices, let's say specifically around grazing, right? What are your thoughts as to that sentiment about them being replicable in their geographies or in their ecosystems rather than scalable in the traditional sense?
You know, I think the hardest thing to scale is what we've got between our ears, you know, is to change in the mindsets. We worked with Birdwell and Clark down in Henrietta, Texas, and they're grazing 6,500 stockers, 55 to 6,500 head of stockers and 3,000 sheep together. They're moving them every day. And it's and Emery's well in his 70s, and I think they've got one helper. You know, so I think it's I want us to go back to local economies with what we're doing, but I have no doubt that the size is really just a matter of the mindsets. You know, Burke Tykert, who's one of our is one of our consultants that is a well-known consultant that ran the Deseret Ranches for the Mormon Church. He says that we ought to be able to run 600 cows per one full-time employee. You know, so it's, you know, and you look at what Eric's doing out there. And granted, that's a little different because he's doing a lot of polywire and things like that. But he could probably run 3,000 head as easy as he can 3 head or 30 head. You know, it's just there really is scale to this, especially from that side and the row crop side. I'm seeing it the same way. So I agree with Will in some circumstances because I think we need to get more local in a lot of what we do, a lot of processing, a lot of things. We really had. You know, back in the, it wasn't that long ago, even the 60s and 70s, we had a lot of local economies and local things growing. I think we need to get back to that. But we've seen some really big operations that are going down the regenerative path and really doing a good job at it.
Yeah. I mean, the biggest pushback people always have when it comes to implementing these systems is that are they sufficient to feed the population that we have right now and their growing protein consumption, right? And I don't know how possible it is to answer that question from a land availability perspective, but certainly from a practice perspective, this is a much better approach. The piece that still seems to be missing just from a data standpoint is, even with all of these other benefits, right, can it sufficiently provide and produce for current volumes and expectations, you know?
Yeah, and that's where I see where Will's coming from. I think the answer is, when we look through the lens of an existing model, we would say no way, right? But when you look through the lens of other ways, you know, there's no more, when you have an operation like Will's that has so many stacked enterprises on 1 acre, you know, I mean, he might have chickens and ducks and pigs and cows and honeybees, and he's got an orchard, and one waste product is feeding enough. You take that acre and look at calories in to calories out compared to maybe like an acre of corn. And so that's what you see. You know, I made a statement one time in one of my classes that the world, you feed the world with backyard gardens. You know, I mean, how much produce can we raise on an acre of intense type thing? And had a person in class that kind of got upset about it and was like, well, there's just no way. And of course, they're looking through today's model. And I had another person in the class ask about the Freedom Gardens. If you remember the Freedom Gardens back. Yeah,
absolutely.
The amount of produce they grew was unbelievable. So I think the answer is somewhere in between somewhere. You know, we're going to have chicken as plentiful and as cheap as we can. Probably not, but you see some of these movable houses that are doing some really cool things, you know, with and so I think that it's in between somewhere, but I don't think feeding the world, the mantra that a lot of the naysayers do, we got to feed the world, that's not it, because, you know, 45% of all corn goes to ethanol. I think it's like 30% of all beans go to soy diesel. So we're not feeding the world. It's just a different model. So I think it's a change of mindset and looking through the lens of a different type of agriculture and a different way. And I would love to see us come back to a small scale agriculture, because honestly, these people that have 200 or 300 cows or maybe farming 5,000 acres, they're not making, you know, I'm 55 years old. I was born in 1970. I still remember as a kid, people could have 400 or 500 acres. They can raise a family. They could put their kids in college and made a fairly decent living. Now we might be farming 5,000 acres and not making that much more. So we've not come a long ways more, and there's less farmers, there's less ranchers, and even small scale guys like us in Missouri, they're just getting out because they're just not making money anymore.
Why do you think that is? That the operations have, you know, essentially 10x'd in size, but have become much less profitable than they used to be. What's broken there?
Well, you got to follow the money when you look at the expenses of like where all the money spent, whether it's fertilizer, seed, equipment. I mean, you know, when you could have a small scale farm and your seed costs were so low, your equipment costs were so low. Same thing with livestock operations. Everybody's got this hay equipment, so they've been sold a lot of things that they have to be able to make it in agriculture. I mean, when you've got a new combine with the headers going for $1 million+, how many acres does it take to try to make that, you know? And so I think economics are really out of whack within agriculture, and it has a lot to do with the farm programs and land prices. There's a lot of different reasons, but I think we've just reached a point to where I don't think we're getting better. I don't think we're raising better food. I don't think we're making more money than a system we had 40, 50 years ago.
When you and I first spoke, you had mentioned a sort of military veteran program that Understanding Ag maybe used to have in the past. Talk about what that was and where it is today, and if it's not somewhere today, where you'd want it to potentially be.
So you guys are going to love the name. So it's Battlefield to Fertile Field.
Yeah.
And we started that program, and we were doing it with the skill bridge, and there's some things that I know enough to make me dangerous, but the program, we're 100% into the program and we know what we want to do. But I think when we started it, we may have kind of went too fast and didn't have everything together. So we've had a whole new board on Soil Health Academy, except the president in the last year. So we kind of stepped back from and said, how do we want to do it? But we were absolutely, in fact, Eric has agreed, and maybe he's listening, so he really knows he's agreed to help us with that program. And for one thing, we're still giving scholarships to any training, like Soil Health Academies. We will give a full scholarship to that. And in the future, I don't want to say too much, but I think we're going to look at it more as like a help. One of the ideas we have is for placements, maybe to be able to then, okay, you attend an academy, we can help you maybe do an internship somewhere. So I don't know if we're still going to go back to the skill bridge part of it, because that was kind of complicated. The Navy had one set of standards, Air Force had another, Army had another, Marine had another, how much time they got off. It was quite a bit of a coordination type thing. But we're an education. Soil Health Academy, we are educators. And so we want to make sure we give anybody from the military that has a military background that try to give them a scholarship to go to NER training. So we can at least give them that part. And then if they want to make a transition, and honestly, we're looking for ideas. That's why I'm tickled to be able to come on this and do this podcast. That's why I'd like talking to Eric. And we actually have a big meeting coming up in January. We're going to talk about this more to see how we want to go into the future. We don't know what it's going to look like, but we do know we're going to do it.
Got it. And just for folks listening who may not be familiar with it, the Skills Bridge program you're referring to is the DoD Skills Bridge program, where veterans, as they transition out, sort of their last 6 months, and correct me if you probably know more about this than I do at this point, but their last 6 months, in addition to remaining on active duty, they have sort of time where they can devote to a potentially new employer on the DoD's salary to educate and intern with this active duty service member to determine if this is something that they'd be interested in potentially transitioning out. And it opens a pathway, so to speak, for whether or not, or if that veteran, when they do transition out, could potentially become an employee of some form.
Yes, that you
Okay.
got it right. And Mike, I'm going to put in a shameless plug. One of the things is we need some funding on it. The Soil Health Academy
Yeah.
is a not for profit, and we would like to have, anybody that's listening to try to have funding, because it's as big or small as we can do it for that. So we're definitely doing scholarships right now, but if we had some more to go with it, we can look at getting back in with the Skills Bridge, and ideally then we would try to work with producers and the Skills Bridge and the veteran to be able to come in, like you said, and spend time on a farm or ranch, get some hands-on experience. And that's the problem we're not the problem, the logistics we're trying to figure out, at what exactly that looks like and how it would go into the future,
Got it.
and how it would be funded.
And so part of that problem with that integration was just a logistical one.
Logistical, I think we just should have done a little bit at a time.
Okay.
Funding, it does, like their salary and benefits and everything are still ongoing, but like we would fund them to maybe some travel or room and board to be able to go stay on an operation, things like that. So is that in between? And again, always looking for suggestions,
Yeah.
but one thing we have not stopped is if you're a military and you want a scholarship to Soil Health Academy, we will provide that.
How do you temper that natural veteran enthusiasm for both feet, totally in the water, jump in with some sage sound logic and reasoning?
That's, because I was that guy. I was 28 years old and bought 500 acres. At the time, it was $300,000. Looking back on it, it's just laughable. But at the time, it was like $3 million. And I spent the next 20 years working off farm, everything else, to try to pay for the farm. And so,
Wow.
I guess the biggest thing is take the best you can, take emotion out of it and make good. Because I've seen a lot of people that are very savvy economic wise, but then get caught up in wanting to, made all their money in business over here and just go over here and just don't do the same type things when they do an agriculture operation. Now, there is nothing wrong with saying, I want to do it and that's enough, but one of the best trainings my wife and I ever went to, and we did it about a year ago, was Ranching for Profit. And, I'm embarrassed that it took so long. It's one of the oldest classes. It's probably been around 40 or 50 years, ranch management consultants. And it really, really gives the economics of agriculture and types and things. So Ranching for Profit, keep that on your little note there.
Yeah,
But
got it.
I would think the biggest thing is to try to take the emotion out of it. And look at good economics and saying, okay, what are true numbers here? Talk to people that have done it. Everybody, I use Gabe Brown, for example. They see everything that's going on now, and they see his soil health now, and they see his stacked enterprises now. But many times what they don't see is the 25 to 30 years of trials and tribulations and things that he had to go through to get to that point. So, talk to somebody that's been a part of it. And again, get involved in it a little bit, go do an intern, go work free for some farmer somewhere and see if that's what they want to do. So we can get at least the cool stuff, that you see on a TV or a movie or on a reel or something. And so, but make sound financial decisions. And then after all that's done without emotion and you say, you know what, we're going to do it whether we make money or not. When my wife and I, my farm is too big for a hobby farm, but too small for a really, and I could do more, but I travel a lot. But we decided that it's worth us to have 500 acres of space. And so if we can do, she's got we got a full-time business here where she's a chiropractor, does nutrition work. So we're, she's busy with that. I travel with my job. So we say, okay, what can we do with the labor force we have? And then we do that and try to do the best we can. And, so it's hard for me to try to raise chickens and try to raise pigs and try to do all this other stuff and then find somebody to help me with it. So I say all that just the idea of like, we understand now, we look at the economics and we make decisions based off that.
Yeah. It is important to note there also that there's no shame in having secondary professions, especially as you get started.
Yeah.
And also building your own agricultural farming practice, right?
That's it.
It's not something that in most cases, the transitioning veteran is going to be able to afford lock, stock, and barrel right out of the gate. They may need to buy something degraded or raw and convert and build and scale over time as their own family and financial situation affords it. And it's okay to have to take other income while you do that. And I think sometimes the veteran has the perspective that it's all or nothing. And it doesn't have to be that. In most cases, it's not that way.
No, and enjoy the journey.
Right.
Again, that's the biggest thing. Try to take the emotion out of it, but enjoy the journey as you get there. And I mean, it takes a while. We've been at this 25, 30 years, and I'm still like, man, I just, you always say you wish you had, but boy, some of these folks that are 25 years old that are getting this knowledge and this, and every generation says that, boy, I wish I'd known this back then, but the journey, enjoy the journey, because this regenerative path, it's just so much fun. It makes you feel so much pause over your world and what you want to do and over agriculture just by trying to do it.
Right.
Yeah.
It's my background is in agricultural engineering.
Okay.
My day-to-day job is in sensor development for plant and animal ag, right? So ag tech is as a passion, and it's also a part of my everyday life. In our earlier conversations, there was one of those sort of early methods of transition is to sort of, in some cases, shed some of those equipment requirements and move to a more biomimicry-based system. So I'm curious as to your thoughts as to what role ag tech plays in or could play in a regenerative system.
I think it plays a huge role. You know, I go down and move cattle and I've got a solar fence charger that is the most neatest thing in the world. It's all built into one thing. It's got a pretty small solar panel. You know, I've got poly wire, I've got reels, I've got composite, you know, I can use drones to check cattle. I think sometimes we get this mindset, oh, regenerative, so we're going to be a horse and buggy. Technology is unbelievable. Now, granted, I got an old 4020 John Deere that I can work, you know, so right. I don't keep anything I don't need. But wow, you know, we've got knowledge, 100-year-old knowledge, with 2025 technology. We got the best of all worlds. You know, I mean, there's no fence, there's collars, you know, there's things we can control our electric fence charger with our cell phone. I mean, I think technology, and again, I don't think it should replace. I don't think, but how much can it enhance me? You know, look at where soil tests are coming. Look where we can maybe have instantaneous Haney type test out in the field. You know what? Yep. So anything that can make us manage better. Again, I want the powers of observations. I don't want it to replace, but I love my technology, and I think it's just going to exponentially just get better and make our world easier.
Is that a conversation or a part of the curriculum that's had when you guys do these Soil Health Academy educational programs or seminars?
You know, if nothing else, it comes in conversation with, hey, what's the best equipment to use? That type of stuff, you know, so it's constant. And granted, there's a lot of stuff out there. You know, I'll use the example of like biologics. Yeah. You know, everybody's wanting to sell a biologic. Well, you know, we're always from the fact of, I think you can do it with other things, but if you want to use it, do a check strip. So no matter, you know, do it. Put biology on one here and not on the other. And I say that with almost anything. You know, if some new great technology that's going to save the world, somebody's selling, okay, try it out, but don't put it over the whole farm. Just try it a little bit, see if it works for you. But I never want to get us into spending money. And we are not, and we're pretty cheap, you know, but I'm trying to pick the right word, you know, we're just not going to spend money that we don't need to spend. Yeah. And that's what we've gotten to in agriculture. We have to have the next baler, or the next tractor, or the next genetic breed, or the next technology that's going to save it. And here, fast forward where we're at right now, we're not making any more money. So I think we need to evaluate everything on how it works for us, what it can do for us, how it can enhance our operations without making it another input or another something that I have to service or, you know, does that make sense?
It does. It's a very prudent point about how technology should not only be viewed and adopted as the producer, but it's a prudent lens through which it should be developed from the engineering perspective.
Absolutely.
As well, right. Absolutely. Just because you build it doesn't really mean they will come.
Yes.
Right. Or because you can build it doesn't necessarily mean that you should. So you've got to be very thoughtful about the way you put these things together, how they're powered, how they communicate, how a user interacts with them, and what sort of value they deliver, right? Yeah. I think gone are the days of information collection and arrived are the days of that information has to be transferred or transformed into intelligence.
Yes. And because it's funny, we have more, especially in the row crop, we have more ability to collect information than we've ever had.
100%.
I mean, we've got monitors, we've got soil tests, but what is it then used for? And like you said, what do we garner from it? And I say this from experience, because when I started out, if there was a new mineral that was going to save my world, I bought it. If there was a new grass that was going to save my world, I bought it. And the missing component was I didn't understand the basics, understanding, you know, the basic principles of why these things did or didn't work. And then when you can understand the basics, and I'm leaning down here because it's like it's way down below, get the basic understanding of why things happen or don't happen. And then I can say, okay, well, if I plant this grass or plant this thing, does it meet those six principles? Be honest with you. If I buy this fancy mineral, does it meet those six principles? And that was the change for me. And honestly, that only happened 6, 7 years ago for me. To be able to look at those six principles of soil health and actually tie them into every decision-making process you do, that can be done with technology. Does this technology actually make something happen or do something better or monitor something? Then I can use and change my methods of operation. And so many people, when I go to consult, what should I plant? What should I do? And usually the biggest thing is just like on pastures, you just need to rest it longer. Or you just need to quit tilling. It's usually the basic things that we have gotten away from. And so same with technology. I'm thinking it's the greatest thing in the world, but you answered it perfect. What can it do for us?
Can I achieve that same end result through some other ecological practice or method that I could with technology?
That's it. Can
Right.
I apply a biologic? Or can I just plant a cover crop and create the
Right.
environment where their biology is going to be there on
Right.
its own?
Right. Right. That's such a
And
good, that's such a good
yeah.
point.
Yeah.
Because it does, back to our earliest point, right? It does take a shift between what's in between your ears, more
Yes.
so than it does what can be created chemically at a lab or built at a as an engineering firm.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And sometimes it's as simple as that's the
Right.
hardest for us to grasp.
Right.
It's hard to work with people when this is too simple. It's the same thing in healthcare. It's the same thing when you see things, it's just, well, I can just change the way I eat, and feel better.
Yeah, right. Exercise. Yeah. Well, you've been so gracious with your time, Eric. I want to make sure I thank you for that. I also want to give you the last word and ask you if there's anything that I haven't asked you or that we haven't discussed that I should
Well,
have.
first of all, thank you for having me on this. I there's never one of these that I don't enjoy, and this has been so much fun. And this is Vets and Podcasts, so I think there's no more exciting time to be in agriculture than there is right now. And if there's a transitioning vet or people, the there's no more fun people to work with, like I said, that come in with no preconceived notions. There's no more fun that people, and sometimes it's tough, like you said, because they buy 40 acres and five cows and they're going to save the world and they're going to live off the land. And you kind of got to say, maybe you need to. But what a fun time to be in agriculture. What a fun time to be able to touch so many different lives on, whether it be like we talked about environment, ecology, food, what have you. And I think what you're doing, because it's people outside mainstream agriculture that are making this movement. It's consumers that are tired of bad food. It's folks that are tired of polluted waterways. It's folks that are just said we've had enough. And so I appreciate what you're doing and be able to get this word out, because we've got to make a change and we've got to do it now. And I think we are. And it just, what an exciting time. I got the best job in the world.
You know, it's one thing to know what you need to change about your own farm, but it's another thing entirely to actually do something about it. I mean, I know this is true in my own farming operation, but it's something different to actually implement these changes. Eric's approach on how to go about gently changing decades of potentially entrenched practices is sage advice. It's probably not a novel idea to you all as listeners, but Eric made a great point about one simple early step for making a regenerative operation more profitable could be is to simply just have less stuff. Well, of course, in order to no longer need that hay equipment, for example, you have to feed the cows through some other means. And in a regenerative system, that solution can come from implementing a more biologically based approach. The same logic could be applied when trying to move away from entrenched practices around chemical fertilization as well. If you'd like to contact Eric, you can find him on LinkedIn or reach out to him through email at eric at understandingag.com. If you're interested in any of their Soil Health Academy training programs or other consultants who might be able to help with your own operation, you can learn more about Understanding Ag on their website at understandingag.com. Thanks for listening to another episode of the Vets and Ag podcast, brought to you by AGD Consulting. If you enjoyed this episode and think other military veterans and supporters would benefit from these insights and stories, please give us a review and share on social media. You can also find previous episodes and learn more about AGD Consulting by visiting our website. Finally, if you have any recommendations of future guests who are military veterans or supporters leading the way in agribusiness, ag tech, or agripreneurship, please send them our way. I'm your host, Mike Desa, and until next time, stay frosty.